Details of Governor Kristi Noem's travel are once again under scrutiny. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, June 2nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Dakota political junkies Tom Dempster and John Hunter join us for insights into the state's top political stories. We'll talk Tennessee today, how the governor got there and how she planned on getting home again. We hear from two high school seniors from Huron's Corinne community in their own words. We meet the new superintendent of Mount Rushmore National Memorial. We'll ask how the pandemic has impacted things like maintenance and a vision for the future. Plus, the thrill of victory and a standing ovation for an honorable defeat. Nate Weck reports on the high school state track and field championships. That's later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. South Dakota lawmakers tasked with redrawing legislative districts will focus on the state's two largest cities as well as Native American reservations. Both the House and Senate committees that are redrawing legislative boundaries decided to create subcommittees tasked with gathering input from Sioux Falls, Rapid City, and tribal areas. Lawmakers are readying to receive data from the 2020 census, develop boundary lines for legislative districts, and approve them by December 1st. But the districts in urban areas and Native American reservations could have the most hiccups. Native Americans involved in the process say it's important to consult with the tribal governments on the process. Some lawmakers plan to visit marijuana businesses in other states and on tribal lands to get a first-hand look at how the drug is grown and sold before it becomes legal for medical use in the state. This month, members of the South Dakota Legislature's Interim Study Committee will visit professional cultivation and retail operations in Iowa, Colorado, and the Flandreau-Santee Sioux Reservation in Moody County. Some members will study medical marijuana, while another group plans to focus on recreational marijuana. Medical use of the drug is set to become legal in South Dakota on July 1st, while the future legal status of recreational marijuana remains unclear. A Native American art gallery in Rapid City shut down during the pandemic, but now two nonprofits are helping the gallery reopen at a new location. SDPB's Jenna Scott reports.
Racing Magpie has brought the spirit of Lakota art to life for nearly 7 years. It houses multiple studios and spaces for Native Americans to create art together. Peter Strong is the director and co-owner. He started the gallery with a clear mission.
Just creating a place where Lakota people and Lakota community and Lakota artists felt centered and uplifted and seen for what they, who they are and what they do.
Due to COVID-19, the gallery shut down for the safety of Lakota artists, and Strong has seen the effects it had on the community.
Devastating for all of us. I got calls pretty regularly and emails from community members and artists and people, you know, really hopeful that we would be able to open back up, and we couldn't.
But with things slowly returning to normal, it's time to reopen, and Racing Magpie needs help. Four Bands Community Fund and Lakota Funds are two nonprofits that make loans to Native businesses. They've come together to loan Racing Magpie money to buy a new location. And now the gallery can soon get back to showcasing art from the Native American community.
Native people, Lakota people, creativity and art is already a part of everyday life. I mean, it's seen in the way people interact with each other. There's song and dance and ceremony and adornment. There's so much already happening in community, and what we're trying to do is bring that together into a space, add strength through community into that.
The new Racing Magpie is being remodeled now. It's scheduled to open by the end of June in Southern Rapid City. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jenna Scott.
For weather today, we're seeing sunny skies statewide with highs in the lower to mid-80s. That's going to cool down to the 50s later tonight. On Thursday, mostly sunny skies with highs in the upper 80s to the lower 90s. And continuing through the weekend, we can see highs touching the lower hundreds in parts of the state. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The world's only corn palace is hoping to grow to new heights as a regional attraction and event center. Joining us today with Insight, we have Doug Greenway, Corn Palace Executive Director. Welcome back, Doug. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you for having me on.
Where are you at in this process of renovation and expansion? Because it's a multi-year conversation for the community of Mitchell.
Correct. So some folks will remember a complete remodel of the Corn Palace lobby and domes and turrets on top in 2014. So nothing has been done to the Corn Palace since then. So our city council had introduced the idea of an expansion of the Corn Palace floor and expanded seating options during the February council meeting. And at that time, the first step was to create what we called a statement of interest, or SOI, that was sent out to designers, architects, construction companies, that kind of thing, much like you would get a request for proposals, mm-hmm. only this was a statement of interest from those who said, yes, we're interested in the expansion of the Corn Palace, and we'd like to come take a look at it and provide a evaluation, is what we're calling it, of potential expansion.
What are some of the things that you learned right away? I'm particularly interested in hearing what some of the visions are for the exterior of the building, because it's not just an event center and it's utilized as such, but it's also this iconic representation of a certain period of time and the palace and the murals. Did people come to the table with some really interesting stuff?
Well, quite honestly, we just got these back to us yesterday, so I haven't had the opportunity to fully evaluate those. There will be a team of Corn Palace staff, city staff, engineering department, look at those and evaluate, score those, and then we'll really be able to pull out of some of the unique ideas and what we like. For the most part, the project scope was to evaluate our current framework of this building, and is it possible for us to get up to 5,000 seats for an event that, and think of it as a basketball game where we would use a floor to watch a ball game. Could we get 5,000 seats? The other scope of the project was to add floor space. So for us to have a vendor show, an egg show, or some kind of a large vendor display, we needed more square footage. We have about 7,000 square foot, and we would like to get to about 10,000 square foot of floor space. And then on top of that, add 2,000 seats to what we currently have. So we have 3,000 seats for a basketball game, for example, or other event on the floor. I just use basketball because we play about 160 games a year in the Corn Palace. Right. And could we expand to 5,000 seats within the framework of this building? And initially, there are some that said, you know, without pushing out walls, raising the roof, lowering the floor, that may not be a possibility. But those are all things we asked them to consider, how we can get 5,000 seats and nearly double our floor space with retractable seating.
Fascinating. All right, what's next for the community? Because as you think about what's realistic, it's also time to think big. What do you think that the Corn Palace provides for the community of Mitchell? And, you know, when you're looking at 5,000 seats, you're talking, what, state tournaments possibly, that sort of thing. What's the potential here for the future?
Well, the intent, obviously, is to bring additional events to the Corn Palace in the city of Mitchell. A lot of folks in South Dakota may not know Mitchell has the third most hotel rooms available in the state, second only to Sioux Falls and Rapid City. We also have a very organized volunteer group that hosts activities. For example, the state baseball tournament, or state amateur baseball, which we've hosted many times very well. So we have a group of folks who do those things very well. We have the motel rooms, we have the restaurants, we have the infrastructure. We just don't have the space. So that was the intent. We have to remind folks that of the nearly 500,000 people that come to the Corn Palace each year, about 125,000 of those come during basketball season, the remainder during tourism season, which we just kicked off the summer season on Monday after Memorial Day, with almost 8,000 people through the Corn Palace over the weekend.
Make a case.
So bringing those extra bodies to Mitchell is what we're looking at, and that's why we would look at an expansion.
Make a case before we let you go, Doug, that it's the Corn Palace and not a new event center of some other configuration in a different location in Mitchell. Why do you think that you would want people to understand it should be here and it should be the investment should be in the world's only Corn Palace?
Well, there's not a large facility like this in Mitchell that can hold large events indoors. So we want to increase that opportunity, but it's very important to me as the director that we maintain this as a tourist attraction. We have that large number of people come every year to see those corn murals on the outside, the Oscar Howe originals on the inside, and maintaining those murals is very important to the Corn Palace and to me, and I think to the city. So if we're able to do that and increase seating and floor space, I think it's certainly a successful project. But right now we're in the initial evaluation stages of what could be. And, of course, when they decide what could be, that comes with a price tag, and ultimately that will determine whether the project moves forward with our city council and things like that. So we're several years down the road, but we need to start somewhere, and statement of interest from designers is our first step.
Yeah, means something to the whole state as well as the community of Mitchell. Doug Greenway is Executive Director of the Corn Palace. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, and we invite people to stop by the world's only Corn Palace.
Ahead on the program, journeying through a serious illness as a whole person, not just as a diagnosis. Dr. Andrew Ellsworth is next. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
As journalists, we strive to tell our audience the facts. What happens if people seek out only what they want to hear?
There are people who are more than willing to tell them what they want to hear. You have more access to information, but not necessarily to the truth.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The role of the media in our democracy. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the South Dakota Shakespeare Festival, June 17th through the 20th at Prentice Park in Vermilion. Live outdoor theater that will beautifully provoke deep thought through laughter and joy. June 17th through the 20th. More at sdshakespearefestival.org.
There is a global scramble on for semiconductor chips and raw materials. And while the focus has been on cars, this is bad news for a whole lot of industries.
Products are delayed, and we're constantly getting price increases. Every day, it's a different problem.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, trying to keep your wine cool. You're going to need semiconductors. It's next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Start your day with credible news and information from NPR and SDPB. Join host John Wynn for Morning Edition, weekdays on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Perhaps never before have so many of us collectively tuned in to our own fragility or even our own mortality as we have been during this pandemic. But talking about things like palliative care and hospice can be a vital way to add quality of life to a family's journey through a serious illness. Dr. Andrew Ellsworth is a family medicine physician with Avera Medical Group in Brookings. He's a member of the On Call with the Prairie Doc team, and he is joining us now to preview the upcoming On Call with the Prairie Doc program. Andrew, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again, Lori.
I want to focus on this whole conversation about palliative care, because we have a mutual friend in Dr. Terry Peterson-Henry, who is one of your guests on this upcoming program. And I've listened to her for years explain to people what it is that she does. But until my father got sick and she walked in the room and sat down with us all around a table and said, "So tell me about Bob," did I really realize the kind of work she does with families and what it can mean. So before we get to any kind of hospice conversation, how do you explain to people what palliative care is?
palliative care is a nice change in our goals of care and the way we're approaching things. You know, traditionally in medicine, we're trying to fix things and cure things, and you know, in some ways, looking at quantity of life. But with palliative care, we're looking at quality of life and what are your goals, what's important to you, and how do we maximize that, and how do we improve and maximize your time with family and your time that you have. And so it's just a complete kind of change sometimes of perspective, and it really can be freeing. And sometimes people even thrive and do better with their disease and prognosis with that change.
Yeah.
And so with palliative care, we're focusing on quality of life and comfort rather than quantity and cure.
So the logical next question is, why don't we do that with all our care of serious illnesses? We do in a certain extent, but when you see a family where all of a sudden, you know, this is a whole new conversation. We're talking about quality of life. Does that an indication to you that maybe something was missed along the way, or is that just baked into how we do healthcare in America?
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of the above. We really should be having these discussions a lot sooner and right away, and even when people are perfectly well and healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And not just with our doctor, but with our family and friends and those that would help make those decisions for us if we can't. And so, you know, just realizing, and of course that's good for us in any day, is to think what's important to me and does this line up with my goals?
Yeah.
It's easy to go down that rabbit hole of treatment and cure. And sometimes we don't allow ourselves to step back and say, okay, is this doing me any good? Is it worth the risk? Is it worth the treatment? Is it worth the time?
Mm.
It might be. It very well might be and could be. But stepping back and sometimes families are so relieved when a provider brings something like this up as an option, because they don't want to come across as that they've given up or something like that. And sometimes doctors and nurses don't want to bring it up either, because they don't want to come across as giving up. But, you know, it's not giving up. It's just aligning our care with our goals and what we want.
Right. Right. In some ways, it could start at diagnosis, because it reminds me of the pandemic,
yes.
Dr. Ellsworth, in the sense that when it started, we were having these conversations not about how will we be, how will we keep our families healthy, but we were at the same time having these conversations early on about who will we be on the other side of this journey? What does the next normal look like? And people were asking big questions. Well, those are the same questions you ask when you hear a diagnosis for a serious illness, for the very first time. How will I endure this? And who will I be? Who will my family be on the other side of that? That, to me, is
right.
Palliative care.
Right.
Am I way off there? Correct me if I'm medically in the weeds.
No, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and having those conversations, everyone wants to a lot of people would rather die at home with their family, in comfort, rather than in a hospital with a bunch of lines and alone.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, of course, this last year with COVID and restrictions, a lot of people did die alone or very, not with family anyway. But unfortunately, a lot of people don't die at home, even though they'd like to. And so, kind of having these discussions and planning things out and helping with these transitions can really be helpful and better for everyone. And so many times patients and family are so happy with palliative care and mm-hmm. with hospice. And one difference is with hospice, in general, we look at the prognosis of the disease and say that they probably aren't going to last any more than 6 months. Mm-hmm. They have 6 months of life left to be expected. Now, you can graduate from hospice. Sometimes people go on hospice and they do really well and they thrive, or the disease gets better for whatever reason. And we say, hey, you're no longer on hospice. But palliative care can really start from the moment of diagnosis, because it's just a matter of what are our goals and treatment, and or what are we going to focus on?
Yeah. I think this is just one of them. I know it's hard, you know, if you're listening right now, it's hard to think about these things and talk about these things, but it really does begin with the relationship with your physician or your provider and the relationship with people in your family, being willing to talk about what is on your bucket list. What are the things that you want to do in your life? What's valuable to you? What sort of colors do you like to be surrounded with? You know, what's your favorite environment? And those conversations can be really fun and delightful as you just bring things up with your family members. So much more in this On Call with the Prairie Doc. So people tune in. People tune in. Hear how I just gave a directive there? Tune in.
I would really recommend this one. It's a special episode.
It is,
Great guest, Franny Anderson with Palliative Medicine with Avera and Dr. Terry Peterson-Henry. With palliative medicine with Sanford. So from both Avera and Sanford there, and both good friends of mine, and actually even to have my grandma on the show too, talking about hospice with my grandpa.
Grandfather.
So,
it's
a special episode.
Yep. We have stories to share, and it's a great opportunity to think and talk about them. So Thursday night, 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SCPB TV, and you can always find them at prairiedoc.org. Or search for Prairie Doc on Facebook and follow them there. That's where I follow the Healing Words Foundation, and lots of good information coming out of there all the time. Andrew Ellsworth, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Ahead on the program, the governor, a private jet, and more talk about transparency and travel. The Dakota Political Junkies discuss You Are in the Moment on listener-supported SDPB.
Moment. Vocalist Nina Freelon says music is like a time traveler, allowing her to exist in both the past and the present. She's titled her first album in more than a decade Time Traveler, and it's dedicated to her husband, who died 2 years ago. The album is filled with reinterpretations of songs they enjoyed together during their 40-year marriage. I'm Carl Gerke, and we'll hear a few tracks from Freelon's latest this evening on Jazz Nightly. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding is provided by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Gene and his team of experienced insurance advisors will insure your home with your specific needs and budget in mind. GeneHufford.com. Coming up on the next Dakota Life, we're hosting this episode from DeSmet, the little town on the prairie.
We say every time we come up, we're just blessed.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, we are. We feel very fortunate.
Meet Shane Anderson. He's no stranger to hard work either, and he's quite comfortable on stage and in the rodeo arena.
Many of us were just shocked. We'd probably taken the paper for granted.
It's the little town on the prairie and so much more.
Thursday at 8, 7 Mountain on SDPB TV.
Support South Dakota music by supporting the network that gives local musicians voice and opportunity. From A Moment in Sound to Jazz Nightly, we're on air and online at sdpb.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. Is Governor Kristi Noem's pandemic political profile a path to a fulfilled promise? And once again, the governor's travel itinerary comes under scrutiny. The Dakota Political Junkies, with a weekly roundtable of journalists, political scientists, and political leaders, take a look at the top headlines, and we offer insight and analysis that gets beyond those talking points and bumper stickers into the heart of the matter. Today, we welcome John Hunter, publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. John, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. I'm glad to be with you.
Also with us is former state senator Tom Dempster. Tom, welcome. Thanks for being here as well.
As am I. Thank you, Lori.
I want to start with some, you know, fresh news, really, as people are analyzing this and trying to figure out, you know, who's leaking what information. And this is all about Governor Noem traveling again. People are very concerned and keyed in to where she goes and how she gets there. So the report comes from Politico, and it is that she flies on Mike Lindell's private jet. He's the CEO of MyPillow. And they go to a Republican Governors Association conference in Tennessee just this last week. And he is not allowed to stay at the conference events, so he leaves. And the report is that she has to find a different way home. Ian Fury with the governor's office, of course, denies that she changed her travel plans and says simply that she always follows the law and reimburses flights when appropriate. That's a quote from Ian Fury's office. John Hunter, let's start with you. Travel and the governor is not a new topic, but this one had a bit of a twist. What do you make of it?
Well, I think Governor Noem has been involved more with national politics than most of the governors that we've had recently. Mm-hmm. So travel is a part of that. And I think the key element is to try to draw that line between what serves South Dakota, what serves the party, what serves a person personally, draw those lines, follow the law. And there is South Dakota law that has to do with this. And, you know, I don't have any particular insight whether that was reimbursed yet or if it was supposed to be reimbursed or any of those kinds of things. I think there is natural skepticism when our governor travels out of state. I think it's, as long as I remember, that's been the concern. Sometimes it's for great causes like economic development, trying to recruit a company to South Dakota. Remember, that was, of course, the plane crash of governor that took Governor Mickelson's life was an economic development recruiting trip out of state. But I just think we'll see more with Governor Noem because she's more active nationally than most of our recent governors.
Yeah, and that brings up an important point. Tom Dempster, if you could spin off on that for me. This is a state, I think all states are probably really keyed in to, you know, where their governors are going and who's paying for it. But this is a state with also this legacy of a plane crash. We all know and remember somewhat of, you know, the weight of loss from that. So people are always paying attention to this. What do you see in this latest concern or questions about Governor Noem's travel?
Well, I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to fly in a private jet.
Shucks, no.
But
invitation?
Don't I wish? But it is a privilege, and it's a special right. It's an advantage. It's an immunity that is granted to a particular person. And when you are in a private jet, you are very special. I mean, it's quiet. You're sitting in a very comfortable seat, fabulous acceleration, and within seconds you are drifting above the fray. And you get wherever you're going in a remarkably short period of time. I think a trip from Sioux Falls to Nashville takes about 45 minutes, and there's no waiting in line for luggage or security or anything. And you step off the plane, and you are relaxed, and you are privileged. But I mean, I've thought a lot about campaign finance law and about what kind of responsibility there is to report these gifts. And it just seems to me, I checked and I think a private jet costs about $5,500 an hour. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that any gift that any political office holder receives should be reported. And you have to suffer or gain from the consequences of that reporting. Beyond that, that to me would be the only campaign finance law that would be required. Get a gift, report it.
A gift from anyone, Tom? This is not someone who's registered as a lobbyist in South Dakota. What are some of the ethical, you know, they're saying it's not illegal. So where does that line lie for you?
Well, let's not draw a line. Let's just say if you receive a nickel or a dime or a $5,500 plane trip, report it. just a matter of your responsibility of holding a public office.
Yeah. John Hunter, the Politico report is unsighted sources, someone who's familiar with the situation. What does that tell you about Noam's inner circle or the reporting of Politico? Any flags fly up there for you when you read the report and it's a source with knowledge of the situation tells us this?
Well, yeah, it could be, if you remember the movie Wall Street, where Charlie Sheen was running onto the tarmac and trying to find out where a particular person was flying, it could be anyone. I don't think it's part of the inner circle of Governor Noam's folks who are talking about this, but it could be an observation. Again, the MyPillow guide declined to say who's on his plane, and he has the right to do that. That seems fine, but I really will endorse Tom's idea of reporting. I think in the let people make conclusions. You know, I've been involved with the press in a long time, and we tend to believe that sunshine helps illuminate all sorts of situations, and people, voters, can make up their own mind whether that is fine to do this or not fine or whatever. But illumination, that we think is a key element here.
Right. And I guess if Ian Fury was here, he might add to this conversation that they had nothing to hide. So you don't need an unnamed source. It's not like she was wearing sunglasses and a hat and sneaking onto Mike Lindell's plane,
right?
Because we are doing it where the sun shines. It's just we've broken no laws. And this is unfair scrutiny is probably, I'm guessing, not to project words, what he would argue here. I want to quick flip to the governor's town hall, so-called by Fox News. Sean Hannity did this roundtable of Republican governors in Tennessee. And if you scroll through that quickly, as I confess that I did, just to get to Governor Noem's parts, she basically focuses on two things. And the first, I think we can all predict, which is, you know, this is what I did during the pandemic. I stuck to conservative principles, and this is how it worked out for my people in the state. And then the second thing she's really talking about expands on something John mentioned a minute ago, which is business development. And she says there's a campaign promise that I made to bring the next big industry to South Dakota, and the pandemic has given us an opportunity to tell our story to people who weren't already listening. So, John, some people here at home have been uncomfortable with how she handled the pandemic, and they might point out, you know, hey, we knew it. She didn't care as much about the people in our lives as she did about the bottom line and the next big industry. Other people would say, well, this is how these two things go together. What do you sort of think about how she is telling the story, John, of behavior during the pandemic and how it helped us tell our story to the world, to visitors, to people who want to move here, and to people who want to open their businesses here?
It is, I think, or she's chosen to use that as an economic development tool, and I don't think that's terrible to do that and say this is who we are and what we've done and so forth. That audience that you referred to, and I did not watch it, but it is by and large people who I think were watching would agree with most of the things that the governors were talking about. And so I think it's a little bit of a reinforcement of what I already believe. You're not breaking new ground with this kind of discussion. This is something that said, look, we believe in this, and you're going to be as an audience are going to be receptive to what we're saying. And both those messages, as you described, Lori, are political messages. Although I don't really get quite the connection between the next big industry, I think it really helps at the margins that there might be some people say, look, I want to go to South Dakota because we have more freedom there and less regulation and so forth. But I don't think that's a whole industry by itself. I think it helps maybe a little bit in each of many industries.
Yeah. Tom, any thoughts on the next big industry and if she has really, I mean, is this gearing up to sort of the next run for governor, perhaps, where she's saying, I promise this and this is how I'm trying to achieve it? What do you see in the next big industry message that she has now?
Well, of course, everything is gearing up for the next run for governor or the next
right.
one or whatever. I agree with Sean. I think this most recent rush, if that in fact is what it is likely to be ephemeral. But what she's done is she has absolutely tied into the cowboy of the American West that's beholden to no one but himself, that can spurn East Coast and West Coast liberals who preach how you preach how you should live and what you should do, even to the point of whether you should wear a mask or not. It'll be interesting to see the longer term data on people moving in. You read reports of housing and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
South Dakota still maintains and will probably forever maintain a very bad ranking on per capita deaths and per capita COVID experience. But just to see, I mean, I've heard all sorts of stories about the Black Hills, and just this morning, kind of expecting this question, I checked with Expedia and just picked a couple of dates, June 22nd to June 30th, and I wanted a hotel room in Deadwood during those dates.
Mm-hmm.
And out of 101 listings, 98 of those 101 are sold out. And I have the opportunity, the one or two or three that is not sold out, Lori, is a Deadwood historic brothel. It's 5 bedrooms and 4 baths that I can rent for $1,000 a night. Now, I don't know if that's economic development or not.
Can we fly there in your private jet, Tom? Because there's a Deadwood vacation on our dock here. All right, I want it. Well, we just go ahead, John.
It'll take us about 10 minutes to get there.
John Hunter, I do want to direct people to your editorial at the Madison Daily Leader about this whole concept of critical race theory and civics and indoctrination. And we don't have a ton of time to really dive into this, but we're going to be diving into it in the whole month of July. So there's plenty of time ahead. But as we direct people to that editorial, John, final thoughts here on... This is really not a conversation in many ways about history or about education. This is politics, straight up the middle of the road. What would you explain to people about the layers of this and how they all point toward, elections and fundraising and all of that?
Well, think first that getting political leaders involved in education curriculum is not new. And that's, I think it's been something that people have asked to do for a long time because they know it can influence things in good ways or bad ways. In most cases, the legislature and the State Department of Education do have some responsibility for overall education, public education in South Dakota. The state taxes funded and so forth. And so it's not a terrible thing to have political leaders and elected officials involved in curriculum development and so forth. The line that we keep talking about lines, don't we? The line that you throw is when you say, look, let's educate people in Republican theory or in Democrat theory. Those kinds of things. Actually, as I read the press release for what, or actually the letter that Governor Noem wrote to the Board of Regents, it did seem as though it didn't seem unreasonable. Now there may be some things behind the scenes that might be pushing a little bit farther, but the whole idea of kind of learning versus indoctrination. Now everyone can define that differently, but that makes sense. The public university should be a place of learning and not indoctrination.
Sure.
And also to students shouldn't have to affirm their belief in anything. Those both seem reasonable. Now,
yeah. That seems a little weird to me.
Where
that's
it
worth,
goes from here, I just don't know.
That's worth talking about in the future. Like, is there some kind of affirmation moment here that I'm not really sure what that is?
Right.
So I look forward to learning more about that. We're going to have to leave it here for now. Dakota Political Junkies, you can hear every Wednesday. And in the month of July, SDPB Spotlight will shine on civics education in South Dakota. And we'll unpack all of this and the lovely gooey mess that it promises to be. And we'll all learn something.
We look forward to listening.
John Hunter.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Tom Dempster, thank you, gentlemen, so much. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Lori. See you, John. Yep.
Take care.
Bye.
Let's take a moment and head to Huron, South Dakota. It's a community that welcomes more than the world's largest pheasant. Huron features snowmobile trails and outdoor murals, a symphony orchestra, and a booming business community. Part of SDPB's Coming Home initiative involved a series of focus groups where participants were offered a stipend to spend time talking about the places they call home. One of those focus groups gathered young people from Huron's Karen community. They're members of an ethnic group from Myanmar. Many Karen people fled their homes because of religious and ethnic persecution by their government. Today we hear from two high school seniors. They'll talk about how they came to make Huron their home, what they love about living in South Dakota, and a few of the challenges they face.
Well, my name is Plarplo Clay, and I immigrated to America back in 2008 when I was just 5 years old. And then I lived in Texas, San Antonio. That's when it all started it. And then I moved to Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska. Those places were big, so my parents didn't like it. So they thought of moving to Huron, South Dakota, and then they found here, and then it was perfect. So I really enjoy living here. It's just a friendly community, and then I love it here.
And I'm Heisei. I am also a senior. I moved here in 2007, so pretty close to Plart, and we first landed here in Lincoln, Nebraska. My parents heard of job offers from Dakota Provision, so that's why they moved here, and we've been here since then.
I think it's also because our parents, it's similar to how we used to live back in the camps, where it's like smaller and we're also not used to like all the big cities and stuff. So our parents can really relate to living here, and they also like, they can also garden and have livestock and stuff. And I think they can relate to that. So that's why they like it.
As for mine, I think just the community and the people that are friendly, and then they just love living here. And then we don't have to, well, for some place we have to go far to get the stuff that we need, but otherwise, good.
I feel like there's always going to be misunderstandings, you know, between us or our neighbors and stuff. And I said this on when Mother Jones interviewed us. They showed us a video of how I think another news source came and interviewed Huron and about like the immigration and stuff. And the person they actually interviewed was actually my neighbor. He lives just behind my house over here. And like, we don't talk that much. And I don't think he has a very good opinion of us. So I think there's always going to be that little like prejudice there, as long as, and we haven't been here that long either. So as long as people like don't know, then there's always going to be prejudice.
Ahead on the program, Mount Rushmore National Memorial. They have a new superintendent. We'll talk with her about the vision for Mount Rushmore's future. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Record companies are reissuing several classic albums from the Jacksons. As we continue to reckon with Michael Jackson's legacy, some critics are wondering if we should also reassess the family's music.
This is a complicated issue that we're going to be dealing with for the foreseeable future, because Michael Jackson's music was so popular and ubiquitous.
Next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the sharp racial distinctions in the way Americans' Second Amendment right to bear arms has been applied. Historian Carol Anderson says the amendment was crafted to ensure slave owners could suppress rebellions, and black people have often been denied the right to use guns in self-defense, with tragic consequences. Join us. this afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
I am pleased to announce that SDPB has been awarded 9 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for our reporting in 2020. Winning categories include writing, video, features, sports, investigative reporting, continuing coverage, and the Overall Excellence Award. Your support makes it possible. Thank you for your partnership as we tell South Dakota stories. Award-winning reporting is what you have come to expect and what we continue to strive for at SDPB.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Mount Rushmore National Memorial is, in a word, colossal. More than 2 million visitors a year journey from all over the world to contemplate one of America's most well-known carved symbols of democracy emerging out of the sacred and wild Black Hills. Now, a new superintendent has taken the helm of Mount Rushmore National Memorial. Michelle Wheatley has been with the National Park Service for more than 20 years, most recently as superintendent of Jewel Cave National Monument. She's joining us now for a look at her new role and the future of Mount Rushmore. Michelle Wheatley, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about why you wanted this appointment. Why, after 21 years or so with the Park Service, Mount Rushmore as the next step for you?
Well, it was a great opportunity to expand my skill set, building up to a lot of work throughout my career, working with partners, communities, in iconic parks such as Rocky Mountain National Park, Yellowstone, in a variety of visitor services positions. I had previously served as a chief of interpretation, education, community service outreach coordinator. Previous to that, a park ranger, education outreach coordinator, and administrative assistant. So all that accumulative together, just preparing myself for this next step in my career. So it's great to be here. I've been a superintendent in 2 other parks. You had mentioned it most recently in Jewel Cave National Monument. And here I am today. I'm excited to be here and ready to go to work.
Now, there's a million things that you do, and I'm sure some of it is mundane and boring. But as you talk about interpretation, it makes me think of, you know, how many times in your career you've probably seen, you know, political furor over a certain, you know, national park site. Or, you know, something is in the news. Of course, we see it here with, you know, different things with Mount Rushmore all the time. But it's about more than just what's carved into the mountain. It is about what curators and education people and gift shop supervisors, how we interpret that story for our visitors. Will you talk about that a little bit, like the responsibility and how you consider it for you and your staff to say it's not just about telling you how these sculptures got here. It's also about telling you the complete story of what this national memorial is.
Sure, and I'm speaking in that a mindset of interpretation. I mean, one of our big challenges is trying to create opportunities for all audiences that come to help people make their own intellectual or emotional connections to the park resources. And here, there are many resources in the park. As you know, the memorial preserves both cultural and natural resources. You know, we've got this dramatic setting with ponderosa pine forests, granite walls and spires here. And so, you know, our job is to really give people the broad scope of picture here of what's going on. We've got, of course, you know, the most obvious, the iconic mountain sculpture. We have many facilities that help people learn about the park. We have ranger guided programs, the museum collection, and more. And so that's kind of to give them the broad perspective of that. And one of the challenges of being an interpretive park ranger is, you know, your audience are so broad. You have 2-year-olds in your audience where you have people of all different intellects and interests. And so it's creating those opportunities for people to have and gain some sort of connection and encourage them to care about and connect to a site such as Mount Rushmore.
Yeah. National Park Service said the 2018, we were looking at $14 million plus of deferred maintenance at the memorial. Talk a little bit about maintenance and upkeep and what needs to happen next at Mount Rushmore Memorial.
So we're in the midst of just kind of on the home stretch of completing a 2-year large construction project here where we did a rehabilitation of construction on the Lincoln Borgum Visitor Center and the Plaza Paver Walkway System. And that also included the Avenue of Flags, where we widened that area with new, we added new flagpoles, flags, new lights, and some of the existing columns were removed so that you'll have a clear view of the sculpture. And so it was really exciting last weekend, just Friday afternoon, we were able to take down part of the construction fence that has been up for 2 years and open up the Avenue of Flags, which is just absolutely amazing for people to be able to spread out and experience the flags just waving in the wind and have that clear view of the mountain sculpture. So that's one of the things that's ongoing. But we constantly have the upkeep of taking care of the different facilities where we have, you know, quite a bit of buildings. We have the upkeep of the other facilities, including employee housing, the structures, the grounds, the utility systems. So we're just on the starting of the architectural design for a new wastewater system. We're going to be replacing the seating in the amphitheater in the next year. And we're also working on a new movie project where we're going to be replacing the two films that we have here, one in our visitor center and also the one that is shown in our outdoor amphitheater for our evening programs. So those are some of the many things going on right now.
So much happening, and you're just now taking the helm. We hope to talk with you in the future about Mount Rushmore National Memorial for our visitors and for our lifelong South Dakota listeners as well. Michelle Wheatley, thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Look forward to seeing everyone here this summer. Thank you.
We close today's show with some news from the State High School Track and Field Championships. The SDPB sports team was there to cover events at multiple locations. Well, I caught up with our sports reporter Nate Weck yesterday afternoon for insight into how the championship unfolded.
Boy, I tell you what, we had rainy, well, it wasn't really rainy, but it was a little cool and windy when setup day happened. But when Friday and Saturday hit, it was actually some pretty nice weather. A little windy on the Friday, but if you wanted a perfect day for track and field, Saturday out in the Black Hills was absolutely gorgeous.
Not too much to complain about, especially after a year of waiting to be outside in these kinds of competition. What are some of the highlights for you as we wrap up that championship?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, if you look at the team results, Sioux Falls Lincoln, Sioux Falls Christian, and Hanson, they all won boys state titles. On the AA side, West Central, Coleman, Egan won on the girls side. And then in class AA on the girls, there was actually a tie for the championship with Brandon Valley and O'Gorman. And it actually came down to one of the final 4x4 races of the girls. And it was decided by, you know, if you're watching the race, and you see 2-3 kids cross the finish line, you're like, okay, who won? So you had to kind of wait for the scores to pop up. And then when you see the results pop up, it's like, oh my gosh, we're going to have a tie for the team title on the girls' side, which is kind of cool to see. And it's what, you know, we were talking about it, Lori, last week too, about, you know, just how that 4x400 relay right at the end of the day is kind of that main event, how team titles are decided in those closing moments and stuff like that. And it was definitely true on the AA side, and which made it fun.
Yeah, because the girls ran last. So that was all that energy is pushed into that race, and they delivered a race to stand up and scream for. Did the crowd respond to that? Was that a kind of a cool moment?
Yeah, it seemed like it was pretty intense there at the moments, because nobody really knew who exactly won. So everybody's waiting for the official, you know, the official times that come out with the censored timings and stuff like that, with all the technology and stuff that they got plastered at the finish line to really figure out exactly what it was. And on the boys' side too, Hanson, they got 10 points by getting first place on the boys' side of the 4x400. If they would have placed second, they would have gotten 8 points, and they won the team title by one. So it really was one of those things, too, where by them placing first in the 4x400 right at the end of the day, that was what they needed to get the victory. So it was cool to see some really tight team races there coming down the stretch.
Nice. Any individual standout performances that come to mind?
Yeah, so there's a couple I'm going to talk about that I thought were really cool that stood out to me. So I was in Rapids, so I was at the Class B location. Angel Johnson of Viberg Hurley actually broke the State B meet record twice in the 100-meter dash on Friday. So he beat the state record in the 100-meter dash in the prelim heat for boys. And then in the finals, he actually broke his own record by another 0.01. So he actually broke it twice, which was pretty cool. And then one of the other things too, and it's trust me, this is positive. So the way I start this off might not seem as positive, but Kaylin Valandra-Prue went into the girls' 100-meter final on Friday, and she actually took a tumble because of a hamstring injury. She's that White River standout athlete that we talked about around the basketball season. She's tremendous for White River in their championship girls' basketball run, and she's going to the University of South Dakota next year for track. So it was really disappointing to see that happen, but then on Friday night, there was a post that her parents had put on Facebook that said she wants to race on Saturday, even if she has to basically crawl across the finish line. So we kind of knew that she was going to run on Saturday, and her first race was the girls her first race on Saturday was the final for the girls 400 meter run. And she did finish behind the pack, but when she came around the last turn to make the final stretch, the entire stands stood up and gave her a standing ovation as she crossed the finish line and placed eighth. So you want to talk about one of those goosebump moments that you really kind of take a step back from the computer screen and kind of what you're working on. It was that 30, 45 seconds of her coming around, the fans all standing up, giving her a round of applause, because you could see she was visibly in pain, but she still made it a point that I want to finish this race, and I want to show people that, yes, this is important to me. I'm a senior, and this is how I want to be remembered.
Oh, wow. A victory lap in a new definition, especially in a senior year that's been a pandemic. Oh, so much. That's got to be great to be in the same physical space as. Wow.
Yeah, it was really cool. And then Red Cloud had a pretty cool moment too. Jade Ecclesy is how you pronounce her name. She won both the 3,200 meter run and she won the girls mile, again, both in Class A. And it was the first time that Red Cloud had an athlete win an individual state track championship. So really cool moment for Red Cloud as well. And, Jade's getting a ton of credit for what she did, and deservingly so. I mean, she went out there and performed well both on Friday and Saturday to bring home not one, but two state track titles for her school. So pretty cool moment. She's just a sophomore, so I think the future is bright for her, and there's certainly going to be a lot of eyes on her as we move into next season.
All right. We better talk a little golf before we let you go, because there's more coming still.
There is. This is the cap-off of the High School Activities Association calendar. It's going to be the state golf championships, the spring golf championships that are going to be taking place next week. The boys B and girls B are going to be in Brookings. The A girls are going to be in Spearfish. And then we're going to have the double A girls that are going to be in Sioux Falls. And so those four golf tournaments that take place next Monday and Tuesday, that'll cap off our school year for the High School Activities Association calendar. And at that point, we say, we did it. We made it through the entire school year. We got all these events in, and I think people are going to look back and ultimately smile.